Hello and welcome to the Playground Podcast. I'm Chris Byrne and I'm your host for this series of conversations with interesting individuals in the toy business. The Playground Podcast is supported by Global Toy News, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. As most of us in the business know, long-term success is often driven by an ability to respond to changing market conditions and changing times. 37 years ago, Build-A-Bear Workshop started making magic, as the company says, one heart ceremony at a time. Despite a pandemic that shut down all the in-person stores and many other events over the past three-plus decades, Build-A-Bear is a thriving, profitable, publicly traded company. Under the leadership of CEO Sharon John, who has been at the helm since 2013, the company has expanded, redefined itself, and moved way beyond stuffed toys to become an international retail, entertainment, and licensing powerhouse. In this episode, I talk to Sharon about the company's unique balance of data-driven insight and heart-filled magic that has made Build-A-Bear not just popular, but iconic. Here's our conversation. I want to start this interview with my favorite Sharon John story. I was in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, many years ago, and had just seen a preview of the line, and I was sitting with you in your office, which was sort of in that warren of hallways and didn't have a window, and you were back there, and we had the most amazing conversation about kids and how they interact with their toys and how they bring it to life. And those are the conversations that you carry through your entire career. And now look at you. That is really what you do, is you make connections between kids and toys at Build-A-Bear.
Wow. I can't remember that you remember that, first of all, because I remember that. But you were already a really important person. And I was not. So appreciate that memory. And yeah, you know, that's fundamentally, I think that's what draws so many people to the toy industry, is you get that. You're not just making products.
Right.
You're impacting children in the way they think and evolve and grow and learn. And it's so remarkable, all the way to like their emotional maturity, right? And if you keep that fundamental aspect of the psychology in mind, you're going to have a better success rate, I think. But it, and then there's this little bit of magic where it's not just about success. It's also a little piece about you want to do this for the right reasons. And I think that sometimes that magic flows through to the end user as well. So at the end of the day, and I think that this came out in that conversation, part of the ability to do that is that we haven't really grown up, Chris. I mean, we can get right back to that little girl for me, you know, and the guy for you, on what we were thinking when we, you know, and that's some of the most fun parts of the creation of toys, is getting down at the tabletop level or down on the floor and working through this product the way the kid would.
And I think it's something that a lot of people have, because I always say, if you're stumped for a conversation at a cocktail party or a dinner party, just turn to the person and say, what was your favorite toy when you were a kid? Because you will open up a wellspring of heart and emotion and memory, because the toys we play with are really elemental parts of our personality development.
100%. I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because it is an important part. These memories stick with you. It's one of the reasons why I love Build-A-Bear. It's one of the reasons why I went to work at Mattel right out of business school. Barbie was such an important part of my childhood. And when that opportunity kind of passed my way, I'm like, I have to do that. And all of these guys, I went to Columbia Business School, so it's a little bit of a quantitative school, you know?
Right.
Most of the guys, and I say guys because at the time it was a vast majority of literally guys, end up in, you know, private equity or investment banking or venture capitalism or management consulting. And they generally thought I was crazy for making this decision. But I'm so glad I did, and I never looked back.
I want to talk about that, because that's such an interesting phenomenon, because the quantitative is important, and it's good that you can read a spreadsheet. I'm teasing you. But at the end of the day, there is no way to quantify that emotional connection a child makes. And sometimes I think in the toy industry, we lose sight of the fact that it's not just an SKU or a number of units sold. It's the impact that has been had on a child.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And it is an interesting balance. At a very macro level, however, I think that that balance in leadership and in business is more important than it's almost ever been. If you're managing your company only by the numbers, or vice versa, if you're managing your company only by, you know, that I think that product feels good or looks good, or, you know, just this gut feel kind of thing. And there are certainly examples where either alone work, but the real unlock of energy and power and success is when you have that transcontextual thinking inside of your company. And it doesn't have to be housed in a single person's head, but you do have to have both of those voices to create a profitable entity that also touches the hearts of people.
Right. But that combination is what I think makes the toy industry unique in our culture and in our business world. And one of the reasons it's so joyful, because if you are a left brain, right brain sort of balanced person, you're in heaven.
It's why I can't sleep. And it's not, you know, if there's other, clearly there's certain industries that are right around that edge as well. Like, you know, you could say that there's certain parts of certainly entertainment or the gaming industry or some of the other things that are close in to what we do that we often engage with in the toy industry. But it's a very special industry, to your point, where we do have both the honor and the pleasure of being kids all day long.
And speaking of pleasure, Build-A-Bear has been doing really well. And Build-A-Bear, you know better than me, started as an in-store kind of experience, but you've had to pivot. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about how you have responded to the situations, what you put in place, and how you're doing now with it.
That's a very long... I'll try to be as succinct as possible, Chris. But, you know, I came in 2013. I've been here 11 years, wow. Which is... Can't believe it. You don't really know when you start how long you're going to stay at a company, but to have been in the CEO seat of a publicly traded company now for 11 years through things with really special, interesting names like the retail apocalypse or the global pandemic, you know, like these really like, you know, scary movie names. Is not what I expected. But what a journey it's been. And I came in 2013, even though the company had been struggling, despite the fact at Maxine Clark, who created Build-A-Bear in 1997, was greatly honored and should be and acknowledged for almost the creation of experiential retail. So, you know, that was a great bellwether, I think, of where we could become. But up until that point, we had focused that primarily as the physicality of Build-A-Bear, of coming in, stuffing your bear, stuffing your stuffed animal, going through the heart ceremony, and focusing on the place, Build-A-Bear Workshop. And we had still been very much focused on malls as a part of our overarching strategy. Malls, we were mall-based, kids-focused, specialty, vertical retailer, right? And by definition, that has some limitations. And it's not as if the company had not explored and tried and thought of some other of these ideas, but one of the things that was, there were three things that were really powerful to me when I looked at this, inclusive of the fact that I had already been on this journey with toys and I just recently worked at a vertical retailer and turned it around. So I felt like I knew a little bit about that. But Build-A-Bear was a powerful brand. Build-A-Bear had tremendous equity. My gut was that its aided brand awareness was in the 90s and that its affinity levels had to be off the charts. And you got to remember, I'd already seen, just having run the U.S. toy division at Hasbro or the preschool global division or worked at Mattel or VTech, I had a lot of those numbers still rolling around in my head. Like I had a good sense of what good was. And it felt to me that the equity of this brand and the power of this brand way far outstripped the actual revenue of the company. and that there was some kind of disconnect there. And so unlocking that disconnect, actually thinking through this in a very, like, I'd say brand-centric yet kind of dry approach for just a moment, I would say that we needed to find a way to monetize the innate value of the brand in other than the vertical revenue, right? So when you think about that, and then the cash flow was great and we didn't have any debt, and I, you know, felt like that there was a road that I could travel for a couple of years here until I figured it out. It actually was inspired, not unlike what, when Brian Golder was at Hasbro and that whole team was there, and perhaps when we sat down and spoke, we were on a journey to pivot that company from a toy company that just happened to house enormous amounts of intellectual property to an intellectual property company that just happened to make toys, mm-hmm. right? And I was there and was actually running the boys division when we launched the Transformers film. So, you know, what a journey from concept to fruition at the most massive level for a situation that literally transformed, pun intended, the company. So I felt like there were some similarities here, that Build-A-Bear Workshop was a retailer that almost, you could use the word, accidentally built a powerful brand one heart ceremony at a time by just piling up this emotion, these memories, everything you were just talking about of like your very special toy that kids just slept with. And we had done these ethnographic studies, Chris, where there a kid could tell you everything about what happened to Build, the first time they went to Build-A-Bear, who they were with, what they were celebrating, what they chose, why they chose it. You know, just the stuffed animal that's sitting on their bed, and the stuffed animal that's never at the bottom of the toy box, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Right? And you're like, wow, this is powerful. And so that concept of, if I could get the workshop, the place, as a part of the idea, not the idea, what could we become? So the idea was to elevate Build-A-Bear as a brand. So we would become not just the retailer that accidentally created a brand, but a branded intellectual property company that just happens to have vertical retail as one of its revenue streams. That you could then build out beyond malls, build out beyond kids, build out beyond regions, then create a licensing arm, an entertainment arm, you know, not unlike the playbook that has been proven mm-hmm. like, across the toy industry, because once you're emotionally connected to the idea, it can be translated into many physical forms. And Build-A-Bear had not yet done that with consistency or in a scalable way.
Amazing. Totally amazing. And then the pandemic came. but I think when I look back at what you guys did during the pandemic was you leaned into your online.
Yes.
You leaned into your online experience. So you really didn't change the essence, right? You kept the brand essence going and you translated the experience, because guess what? Everybody was going online to have an experience. So that worked actually really well for you.
Yeah. And what, in some ways it was very fortunate that we had been doing so much strategic work prior to that event. And we had already recognized that, you know, like I said, we were created as this, you know, vertical mall-based kids-focused retailer. And we realized, just like, again, a number of toy brands, when they hit about that 20th year, there's a moment when they can evolve to be multi-generational. You have to be planful about it. You have to think about it, but we hit that. We had just recently hit that mark and realized that we were very still emotionally connected to the kids, the adults now that had been to Build-A-Bear when they were little. Mm-hmm. So we went on a very concerted effort to expand the consumer base and expand the reasons why, from gifting to social media, to the evolution of our licensing strategy, to the creation of a microsite called the Bear Cave, that's age-gated, where things are a little bit cooler and a little bit darker. So we could have things like the Deadpool Bear, right, or the Matrix Bear, or a whole collection of products called Build-A-Bear After Dark.
I remember that.
Right. And it's still a big part of what we do today. So that, what we then created was a situation where the online and the in-store ultimately had a little bit of a different profile. The stores were over-indexed on kids, the typical approach that you might think. And with birthdays being about a third of our business, and online wildly over-indexed, mm-hmm, with collectors, gifters, affinity guests, people that might not even be Build-A-Bear fans as the number one thing, but they might be the fan of the Matrix. So they've got to have the Build-A-Bear Matrix, mm-hmm, you know. And then there were these overlap licenses like Pokemon or Hello Kitty or Harry Potter that appealed across the board. And so we had built out a very robust e-com business, because there's some point when you're running a company and you see the shifts in the macro economy and you're like, you know what? I know we're an experience-based retailer. I get it. But we don't have the luxury to not participate fairly in the largest growing revenue, you know, generating retail arm in recent history.
Right.
So it's not, are we going to do this? It's how are we going to do this? And when you ask teams, sometimes it's just asking the teams the right question. It's not an option. We are going to. So tell me how. Mm-hmm. And it was to build out this different space. And so we were up and running on that. And here's where the luck comes in. We had, in January of 2020, flipped the final switch on a new warehouse management system that put the last pieces of the puzzle in place for us to be able to buy online, ship from store, buy online, pick up in store. And so the teams, like you've heard these stories over and over again, our teams, once we realized this was our only source of revenue, we literally shut down 100% of our retail operations in a 48-hour period.
Oh, my goodness.
Except all of the stores, because even though I take offense at this, we were considered, non-essential. So in the whole government COVID approach to what retailers stayed open and didn't stay, because I thought teddy bears were pretty essential during that time period.
I think
we all needed some hugs. Yeah. And fuzzy hugs would have helped us a lot. But we maintained our operations and our warehouse operations. And as soon as we could open back up, we opened our stores back up to be able to build those bears, and brought we furloughed 90% of the teams, brought them back on board. And we were able to pivot the company very, very quickly to now, since I've been here, the e-commerce as a percent of our total sales has gone from something like 5% all the way up to like between 15 and 20%, depending on the quarter or the year.
You sparked so many things. Talking about non-essential, that's been a battle that the toy industry has fought since World War I. Seriously, I mentioned this when I talked to Andy Kaimak, A.C. Gilbert fought to make sure that the toy industry was essential at the congressional level in order to get the materials that they needed to make toys. But you talk about kidults, really, with the Build-A-Bear After Dark and all of that. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about this kidult trend is it's not really different from what people always did, which is they always collected, whether it was Staffordshire pottery in the beginning of the 19th century or, God help us, Hummel figures, which my mother collected. people still want to collect. But the question with kidults is, what is the next generation of kidults going to be collecting, right? So you are establishing, you have this dual strategy where you become enmeshed in a child's life so that when they are 20 years down the road, they still have that brand identity or brand affinity, and they want to then continue that in something more sophisticated. I just think that's brilliant.
It's just the magic of the heart ceremony. I really, and the indelible mark that we make on people when they have their fifth birthday at Build-A-Bear, or they go in after they've won the soccer tournament, or they have a Girl Scout party at Build-A-Bear. They remember these moments. And so it's a little bit two-pronged. One is it's such an important memory, and this is great for the toy industry. It's great for other brands too. But when you were so endeared to someone as a child, the first thing they want to do is make sure that they're sharing that memory with their own children.
Right.
So that creates a little bit of a flywheel effect. Now, the second piece that takes a little more mindfulness is, can you then also create a more lifelong relationship with the adult as the adult? And so we see it as that we can do both. And have proven, you know, with our results that you can do both as well. Interestingly, too, the fact that we've been around for now over 25 years, I kind of believe that the people that are sitting in some of the offices making the decisions on who's doing what license with whom, they actually have a tremendous affinity to Build-A-Bear. They want to see their brand in Build-A-Bear too. So that goodwill goes a long way.
And you've also, we talked a little bit about entertainment, and you were there for Transformers, and you've really done an amazing job with Build-A-Bear in this area, especially the niche of Christmas, right? You've got Glisten and you've got that whole line of reindeer, which are adorable, but you, rather than waiting for a studio to say, why we like you, you went out and did it yourselves.
Yeah, on a number of fronts. So this was another piece of the puzzle. So we had the retail piece of the puzzle, and I haven't gone into that, but we had to, you know, return that to real profitability and improve our footprint to be more diversified from malls, which, you know, we've gone into hospitality and, you know, we've created new business models, including partner operated. And now we're expanding internationally. So that's a much different footprint and a very healthy revenue stream for us. Like, we have 25% four-wall profit in our retail stores, and it throws off a good amount of cash. And the reason I'm sharing that is because it's that piece of the model that allows us to build new revenue streams, right? And so that had to be very healthy for us to expand the way we've expanded, because that's a core piece of who we are. But to your point, when I joined in 2013, we were still a little bit in the early stages, but you could see this coming, a massive shift in the media environment and the marketing environment on how to speak to and reach kids. Mm. You know, for years and years, Chris, you know this, it was a pretty traditional approach. You make a few commercials, you get a media buying company, you assess the right reach and frequency, you're on Saturday morning television and a handful of channels, and you can pretty much predict the way it's going to go down, right?
Yep.
But with the changes in media and streaming and VOD, that was not already going to be a sustainable model. And so simultaneously with recognizing that we were going to have to be in the content creation business, whether that's because really commercials were just content, commercials are just content. That's what we did in the toy industry. We created content. I needed to not think of our business as I've got all of these standard bears, you know, or bunnies or dogs or whatever, and a lot of licensed product. Build-A-Bear needed the space in the middle with character arcs and story arcs and, you know, things that we could connect with, you know, kids on a deeper level, not here's this cute bunny, even if we've named it, I'm going to dress it. And I wanted the individuality, don't get me wrong, but there's also a place for us to have stories. Now, we have a ton of research. I know what colors kids like. I know what things they're buying. This is real time for us, right? We have the personal one-to-one connection with our guests because we're vertical. We have the loyalty program. I have that first-party data, right?
Right.
And And so we created at that juncture years ago, a number of different intellectual properties. One of them was Merry Mission. One was Honey Girls. And we thought, wow, to your point, instead of waiting for someone to come to us, we thought we'll go out and prove the point in our microcosm of how popular Honey Girls can be just on the backs of like a few little music, CGI music videos that we created, millions of views. And then we were able to talk to Sony about the creation of a Honey Girls film with these proof points. You know, in my microcosm, Honey Girls outsells this property that was a big movie property or this property in this tiny, you might imagine, right? And so for the interesting piece about Merry Mission, to your point, that was a very data-driven concept.
Oh, I love this.
We were not getting our fair share of the traffic increase of the mall during the fourth quarter. Just if I just did the lines, just did the curves, I'm like, and then the curve would just get getting wider and wider and wider as it got closer and closer to Christmas. I'm like, that makes no sense. We're practically the only toy store in the mall. How could that be? So we started doing some research on it. And what we discovered is that in many ways, even though the family is coming to the mall, in many cases, they're coming, you know, to either they're going to do, you know, split up and do the shopping for the other parent or the siblings, or they go to see Santa, the traditional sort of mall experience. They were actually avoiding Build-A-Bear because Build-A-Bear is what's going to be under the tree. No. We don't need to go to Build-A-Bear before Christmas, right? Think about the psychology of this. Like,
of course.
Almost every parent does that. Of course, we're not buying that, this and that, you know, right now. You know, Christmas is 2 weeks away. That, you know, but we're like, oh my gosh, we need to, people want to be in Build-A-Bear. We need to create a reason for us to be a part of the tradition of Christmas, not the result of Christmas. So we created this entire storyline around Glisten and the Merry Mission. And the challenge was that the nice list was just too long and Santa had run out of presents. But fortunately, the reindeer knew of some other workshops and everybody loves Build-A-Bear. I mean, it was that simple, that way, way, way back in the day. And we did a little storybook and we kind of captured the essence of that story in our windows and in our commercial and our marketing. And it has since been the best-selling collection during the holidays for us. It's bridged that gap on the traffic in the back half. And now we have our own film, Glisten and the Merry Mission. And it's all about coming to Build-A-Bear with your family, having that moment, collecting these reindeer over time, learning about the new characters. And, you know, I love that story. Because I think it's just a great case study of how you can let data kind of drive insights and then use the consumer's behavior and feedback to help you with what the answer is. And it's really led to a mantra of ours called consumer-centric, brand-building, data-driven, money-making. Like everything that we do, it's got to get pushed through that filter with the consumer in the center. And I think it's made a big difference at the company.
I think so too. And in and among all of that is powerful narrative, because that's where the kid connects. You set it up, right? You set up the whole structure with the data-driven money-making and all of that stuff. But then at the heart of it is that child's eyes light up when they see the character. And that's that moment, that ineffable moment when the magic really happens, but you've set up the structure to allow that to happen.
Yeah. And Chris, you know, we as toy people love that moment. And probably I would say my most favorite thing about being a vertical instead of a wholesaler, which there's nothing wrong with being wholesaler. Like, you know, I grew up in that. But that's an immediate feedback. Mm. And my thousands of bear builders scattered across the globe experience that firsthand every day, tens of thousands of times around the world. And that bubbles up to us. It's so energizing because there's no disconnect. We hear right from them. It's just magical to know that you're touching kids that way. It's touching their hearts and letting them get their own special furry friend. In many cases, they keep for the rest of their lives.
As you said earlier, Build-A-Bear really was the pioneer of experiential retailing. And where I live, where I can see the old toy building from my living room, there is now a Lego store. There is a Harry Potter store. There is Camp down the street. All of these are experiential toy stores. And experiential retailing is becoming such a big part of the total consumer experience. If somebody wanted to create experiential retailing, what advice might you give them?
Well, I think that your insights and observations are correct. There needs to be a reason for people to get up and go somewhere. And they have a higher expectation in today's market of what they might have had before. I caution believing that it will all work out if you're focused just on the transactional aspect of anything that's going on, the exchange of money for goods or services. I think the way to break through today is to have that insight on what are you bringing to the party that's a little bit special. Now, it doesn't always have to be something that is so physically happening around you. It can be something that's very personalized that you get in a more rapid way. So there's some spectrum of experience to personalization or intersection of the two that I think today can separate a retailer from being purely transactional. Understanding that you've got to get people to want to get up, get in their car, or in Manhattan, get on the subway or take a walk to go there. And you're asking a favor of the consumer, so make it worth their while.
Before I let you go, because you have been so generous with your time, before I let you go, you've taken on yet another mantle. You're the incoming chairman of the Toy Association board. What do we have to look forward to in the Sharon John regime?
Well, I won't call it a regime.
I know, I'm kidding you. It's after that new TV show.
But this is an honor. I've been in the industry for 30-ish years now. Started, as I mentioned, at Mattel back in 1996. It's a real labor of love because this industry matters. Mm-hmm. We impact generations. We influence children that of today on maybe how creative or collaborative or they are, or you know how big they dream. And it's hard to fathom other than the meeting the basic needs of humans. What could be more important than that? The education and emotional connection of children. So I want to see us rise up to that as understanding of what we're truly capable of and how important our role is. And in some ways, realizing that it's just so much more fun to play together. And that our industry is not just that physical attribute of a plastic or a wooden or a plush toy anymore. We're the bigger idea. And we have lots of other folks in the sandbox that I think we can bring in and create a larger impact. So that's what I'm hoping to be able to do.
And I believe that you can do it. And Sharon John, this has been another unforgettable conversation. Thank you so much for spending the time with me today. I am really grateful.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks for all you do for the industry.
Thanks for listening. I could have talked to Sharon easily for hours more. And if you want more of Sharon, I highly recommend checking out her book that came out last year. It's called Stories in Heart: Unlock the Power of Personal Stories to Create a Life You Love. I promise you, it's worth your time. The Playground Podcast is supported by Global Toy News, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions for future guests. We'll see you next time.